Everyone, this is Lessons in Leadership. That is my colleague, Mary Gamba. We kick off the program with our good friend, a terrific attorney, part of our series, Leaders in Law, with Thomas Scrivo is managing partner. O'Toole, check out past interviews with Kevin O'Toole, O'Toole Scrivo. And as I said, part of our series, Leaders in Law. Good to see you, Tom.
Great to be here, Steve. Thanks so much for having me.
You got it. And people can check out interviews we've done with Kevin O'Toole, also the chairman of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. You and O'Toole came together how and when? Explain that.
So we actually met the first day of law school. We were the back row people in the law school class. Seton Hall Law School, yeah. This is August of 1986. I'm dating myself, but that's when we met. We quickly became very close friends. We each went our separate pathways. Obviously, Kevin went the political pathway as well as the practice of law. I practice in larger firms. A few years back, we decided to combine our practices under one roof, which is what we've done for the last 8 years here at O'Toole Scrivo. So it's been great.
Make it clear to folks that you have had a variety of roles, and you can look up Tom and the Wikipedia search will tell you what you need to know. But also, you had a very important leadership role in the Christie administration. Talk about that.
I did. Back in 2015, Governor Christie asked me to be his chief counsel for the time period that he was intending to run for president. So that extended from 2015, roughly in July of 2015 to May or so of 2020, so 2017, so roughly 2 years. It's probably the toughest job I will ever have. It certainly is the toughest job I've had so far, but it's an amazing time.
Why, Tom? Why so you've had so many challenging roles? Why was that so challenging?
I think just the number of decisions that reach your desk on a daily basis and the magnitude of the issues, you know, a decision that affects millions of people always seems to carry some more importance than one that affects just a couple of people. So those are the types of decisions you deal with every day.
Interesting. Mary, jump in.
Tom, we talk a lot on our Leaders in Law series with lawyers, with those who have worked in the legal profession for decades. What has changed? What has stayed the same for the up-and-coming legal professionals that you're starting to see enter the workforce? What skills, attributes, we're talking leadership, communication, grit, whatever you know feel is needed for these young professionals? And is it different today than when you entered the field years ago?
It's definitely this great question, Mary. You get that a lot. And it's something that we actually grapple with here at O'Toole Scrivo in terms of meeting the needs of the next generation of great lawyers. Grit is a great word. Tenacity, hard work. The hard work will there is no substitute for hard work, and there never will be in my mind. But what's changed, obviously, is the technology. We went from, I think, when I started practicing, we started getting automation, right, between fax machines and emails, and all of a sudden, now we're getting innovation. So we're going from, I think, an automation to an innovation time, especially with artificial intelligence and how it's being used in the practice of law. And it's a great opportunity for young lawyers to actually be in a position to help mentor more experienced lawyers who don't have the ability to grasp these issues so quickly. There's a big focus on in the law schools of AI and how it's going to affect our practice. And so I do think there's a great opportunity for young folks to get into this area and to see how law will change. I think I think it was Bill Gates who said you typically underestimate the changes that can occur in 2 years and overestimate those that can occur in 10. What's going to happen in the next 10 years in the practice of law is something I don't even think we can imagine yet. So I think it's a great opportunity.
Hey, Tom, we had your friend and colleague Keith Banks on recently. He was talking about his extraordinary leadership journey. But the two of you are involved with a group of folks who are attempting to start a new bank again. And I think I asked myself, Tom's running a law firm with Kevin O'Toole. He's got all these responsibilities. His family is very important to Tom. I happen to know a little bit about Tom's family. He's a family person, and being with his family his wife Sue, their family. It matters a lot. What the heck is this new Liberty Bank in New Jersey, and why would you, with all the things you're juggling, be engaged in that?
Well, it's a new venture because there's a need. There has been a void of community banking in New Jersey that started about 20 years ago with the consolidations of banks. There used to be 150 or so banks headquartered in New Jersey. They're now down to 50. And the ability for small businesses, young people starting out, and others to have access to credit is something that has dramatically decreased over the last 15 to 20 years. So what this venture is looking to do is to fill a void and help people, particularly small businesses, grow. Because if you're dealing with the larger banks, not that we're going to mention any of the names, they're not looking for customers that are starting new businesses and just starting out. And those are going to be the future of New Jersey. So if not us, then who? And I think this is really born out of a need. And obviously, you mentioned Keith Banks, who has been, you know, an incredible partner in starting this and launching this venture. I would not have thought of doing this. I would have thought, but I wouldn't have executed on doing this without Keith's blessing. And he's just an enormous help in all this. And I think we make a pretty good team.
Absolutely. Mayor, jump back in.
Stay on that a little bit. So Steve talked about, you know, wearing so many hats, doing so many things. So obviously being an entrepreneur, taking on these different responsibilities can have an impact on wellness. And again, we talk about wellness. We try not to say work-life balance because obviously that's sometimes impossible.
What's it look like, Mary?
I haven't figured it out. And if anyone who's watching today has figured it out, please shoot us an email and let us know. But Tom, what is your perspective on work-life integration? We'll use that term. What recommendations do you have for folks watching today of at least trying to capture the importance of being with family, your hobbies, et cetera?
I think the ability to turn things off is important. I think we have the biggest challenge we all face is the inability to be present in a moment. And so if we can, you know, obviously we work very hard. I think we can walk and chew gum and do these other types of things that bring us rewarding and fulfilling experiences. But the ability to turn that off and to be with your family and wherever that is, right? Whether it's on the golf course or at the shore or at the beach or on vacation or just at home and to be present gives you an enormous ability to separate that 24-hour addiction we have to the to the phone and to work. And to just have some separation and enjoy, in my case, my grandchildren.
Yeah. But Tom, there's a follow-up to that. And again, Tom, very committed to his family, as he just described. But I got to ask you something. Every time I've called you or Kevin, right, I know when you can, you pick up. Because you know Adubato needs something. There's a problem, whatever it is. So how the heck can we, Mary, I know the word balance is the goofy word. How do we integrate on some level balance, being accessible and available, which is part of what makes you and O'Toole and some of us successful, because we're responsive to each other while we're still being present outside of our work. How the heck does that work?
Well, it's a balance, right? And that word balance, I join you in the chorus of not liking the term work-life balance. It just, right. I don't know what it means, and I don't know how you achieve it. But I do think there's room for everything, right? As I said, we can walk and chew gum. We can do these things, and you know, there just has to be some lines that exist. I'm sure there's times, Steve, that you've called and we haven't been able to get back to you for, you know, a couple of hours. Those couple of hours may be something very precious going on in our lives, and when we call you back. It doesn't mean we're not accessible. It just means that we weren't able to get back to you with the urgency that you're accustomed to. But at the same time, we're still able to meet the needs of all of our clients, our employees, and most importantly, our family.
Tom, I'm not complaining that you didn't call me back. Will you stop? And by the way, Tom and Kevin do work to find that, not balance, but try to make sense of it all, because being responsible, and by the way, Some people who think they're dealing with a crisis, it may not be a crisis because some of those folks, everything's a crisis. But Tom, I want to thank you for not. Go ahead, Tom, final point.
Yes, Steve, I often stress this concept at the office, which is there is a real difference between something that is important and something that's urgent. And so everything is important. There are issues that are important every day, but they may not be urgent. And so what we try to do is I try to instill in the folks here the difference between importance and urgency.
And Mary Shaker, Mary, I know what you're thinking. Okay.
I love that. I'm writing that down.
She's like, "Hey, Steve, everything's not a crisis." I get it, Mary. Okay. Tom Scrivo,
Yep.
managing partner, O'Toole Scrivo, and Tom will follow the new initiative with Liberty. All the best to you, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks, Mary.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. This edition of Lessons in Leadership is made possible by the Buccino Leadership Institute at Seton Hall University, Prager Metis, Valley Bank, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 825, the North Ward Center, Gingoli Construction, the New Jersey Sharing Network, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, The Helix, Fedway Associates Inc., the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, Choose New Jersey, and Seton Hall University, showing the world what great minds can do since 1856.
This is Mary Gamba. If you want more leadership tips and tools, log on to stand-deliver.com. That's stand-deliver.com.
Promotional support for this edition of Lessons in Leadership with me, Steve Adubato, and my colleague, Mary Gamba, has been provided by NJ.com, NJBIA, and New Jersey Business Magazine, CIANJ, and Commerce Magazine, and the Meadowlands Chamber and Meadowlands Media. We're now joined by Dr. Ralph Tolati, who is Assistant Vice President for Organizational Leadership at Rutgers University, author of Post-Crisis Leadership: Resilience, Renewal, and Reinvention in the Aftermath of Disruption. Ralph, good to see you.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me. Nice to see you and Mary.
You got, hey, first of all, define disruption.
We're dealing with a lot of disruption across our higher ed sector and across the country. And I think when we talk about disruption, it's sort of a deviation from or impact on our shared experience, our shared set of values, our shared set of principles. It's a disruption in sort of how we understand ourselves and our relationship to others.
Yeah. In the book, you talk about the fact that, and again, I'm a student of crisis leadership. I wrote a book a few years back, published by Rutgers University Press.
Absolutely. I've read it.
It's called What Were They Thinking? It's all about crisis communication. But in your book, which is really interesting, it's like, okay, we're dealing with the crisis, the disruption, got to get through it. You talk about what the heck happens after. What do you mean by leadership after the fact, Ralph?
Yes, Steve. So, there's a lot, as you know from your own research, a lot written on how to prepare for crisis and manage risk. And then certainly a lot of growing literature in terms of what to do in the midst of crisis, in the midst of that disruption. Where I wanted to contribute to the conversation was really on the leadership imperative in the aftermath of the disruption. So what are those post-crisis leadership imperatives?
What are some of the keys to being the best leader one can be when the wave has subsided for the disruption slash crisis? Please.
I think there are a few things. One, how do you encourage learning? So what are the ways in which you as a leader are encouraging learning across your teams, across your divisions, across your organization to debrief what you just lived through and preparing for what inevitable disruption might come next? How are you tapping into the resilience of your communities in weathering the crisis that you're currently undergoing and also building resilience for whatever might come next? I also talk a lot about meaning making. What are the ways in which leaders are using language and narrative to construct meaning in the aftermath of these events that sometimes are senseless or lack meaning? Advancing renewal. So, what are the ways in which we're healing and moving beyond the crisis itself? And all of that really speaks to the importance of the leader and being able to sort of tap into the real, the change that might be possible in the aftermath of crisis. So, what are the ways in which you can pursue reinvention?
Now, Mary, how much do you and I, as leaders of our organization, or particularly our not-for-profit, production company in the midst of COVID, which millions of other people were not only trying to survive, but then the aftermath. We've been dealing with the aftermath for years now and asking ourselves, what have we learned from that? How have we changed? How we have evolved, et cetera? And how do we prepare for the potential again? And we've become a totally different organization. Pick it up from there, Mary.
We truly have. And Ralph, one of the areas that you talked about when you talked about the five core leadership principles when dealing with a crisis is, and I just want to look at my notes, inspiring growth. And what was strange for all of us is that when COVID happened, when we were all transitioning, pivoting, trying to figure out, all right, how are we going to deal with this? So many of us still continue to grow, evolve. Talk about that trait, if you will, or that part of dealing in a crisis, inspiring growth. How do you do that while you're also dealing with a crisis? Why don't you just want to put your head in the sand?
That's it. Oh, well, how tempting of a tendency it is to do just that, right? When you're triaging whatever's in front of you in the moment, I think the real opportunity here, embedded in crisis, disruption, uncertainty, are to figure out what are those growth points? What are those opportunities where we can rethink how we're approaching core functions? What are the ways in which we can think about who we're becoming as an organization as a result of what we've endured? And so that reminds us of that twofold focus of crisis. There's danger, there's fear, there's uncertainty, there's risk, but there's also opportunity. And that opportunity has to be leveraged by those who are called upon to lead.
How and when did you become fascinated by leadership, particularly this aspect of leadership and disruption / crisis?
Great question. So I, as an undergraduate student leader at my institution, we sort of experienced a crisis. So that gave me a front row seat into how an organization comes together in the midst of crisis. Went on to do my master's and then my PhD, where I was studying crisis at our alma mater, Steve, at Rutgers, where I did my PhD, and really looking at crisis leadership across higher education. One of the themes that came out in the research I did was this sort of countercultural need for agility, that educational organizations often are organized around consensus, collaborative decision-making, and crises threaten that. They require urgent, swift, well-coordinated responses. And so I've really devoted a lot of my career to helping build capacity for educational leaders who are seeking to engage in effective crisis leadership. And certainly, you know, COVID, what punctuated the importance for having leaders who are well-equipped to respond to the pressures of our time.
But you know what? Mary just had a son graduate a while back. College, we did as well. She has one in college now. We do as well. And I keep thinking, okay, so higher ed experienced a crisis during COVID. It's got another whole different set of disruptions / mini crisis, and maybe not mini, dealing with the federal government right now, dealing with questions of academic independence, dealing with questions of economics. Excuse me. How the heck can you begin to plan for what you're going to be when you get through this, when you're trying to keep your head above water and pay the bills and keep your students? How the heck can you do that when you're trying to survive?
It's such a timely point. And some are suggesting that we're living through a state of polycrisis right now for all the reasons you just mentioned, sort of figuring out what's the main source of the issue. I think there are a couple of things. One is to go back to principles. Talk a lot about values-based leadership being particularly important during times of crisis. What do we stand for? And what are the ways in which those values will help serve as a guide for how we're going to weather the turbulence of our times? I think the second is to make sure that you're taking care of your people, that these are trying times, and crisis leadership really contests leadership teams and organizations. So what are the ways in which we're understanding the pressures of our moment, taking care of one another? And that's the process of resilience, as well as we're caring for one another and trying to figure out a coordinated response to the various challenges of the time.
Hey, Mary, you know, it's an interesting point as Ralph talks about this. I wouldn't call it a crisis, but even our organization, excuse me, we're facing, hey, the economy is what it is. There's consolidation going on in organizations. So we get anxious. I wouldn't call it a crisis, Mary. We get anxious about the fundraising part. It can create tension among team members. But Ralph's talking about taking care of each other during that time. Mary, does that resonate for you?
It totally resonates. And Ralph, I'm sure you agree. It's about lifting one another up. And it's about being vulnerable without panicking and running around and saying the sky is falling. And there is that fine line. And I would love for you to talk about that a little bit more. How do you keep that level of optimism during a crisis as a leader? As Steve often says, it's important to show that you're a human being, that you're vulnerable. But people around you also want to see that, they want you to say things are going to be okay. Where does that balance come in?
Fascinating. I mean, I think there, when you think about the work of leadership as a communicative process, there's the leader as performer and the leader as human. And I think both of those domains come into play during times of crisis. So certainly to be authentic, to know what you stand for, to ensure your teams and organizations understand the criteria that you're using to make the decisions you're making as a leader are really important. But how often do we hear of individuals reflecting on their leaders during times of crisis? And what are they looking for? Optimism, presence, hope, and how critical it is for leaders to show up in these moments in ways that do exactly what you just said, Mary, lift others up, try to envision what that desired future state might be, and harness the opportunities that might be made possible as a result of the storms we're navigating today.
Ralph, let me just push back a little bit. How the heck, our people are looking for confidence, as Mary said, optimism, but then we're also looking for vulnerability and honesty. So right. Here's the question for those of us in leadership positions who know that we're ultimately responsible for everyone on the team, getting a paycheck every 2 weeks, for having health insurance for our people, having a pension plan for our people, creating a work environment that makes sense for our people with their personal and family lives. How about if the leader is scared to death? How about if the leader is not sure about the future, not overly confident about the future? When people don't want to hear you're scared, you're nervous, you're feeling vulnerable, you're worried yourself. Basically, I think at times being a great leader means faking it. You say.
Interesting.
Literally faking it. I'm not going to tell you how I really feel. I'm not going to tell you what I really think. I'm not going to tell you how worried I am. Because if I do, it permeates the organization and then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, well, I think, I mean, inviting some degree of vulnerability is a way to humanize the leader.
I think strategic vulnerability, but go ahead.
I think that's exactly right. And I think people can see through it when you're portraying confidence, but you're shaken at your core. Right. And so I think a little bit of vulnerability, especially when you're dealing with polycrisis or crises, right, that are threatening, that are disruptive, that shake us to our core. I think understanding the vulnerability and acknowledging it is clear, but it's the invitation for a leader to show up and to help move the organization forward, even when the future is uncertain. And this is where I think the shared leadership, Steve, becomes so important, because we often sort of put the burden on the one leader who we're looking to sort of create and charge forward in the midst of the crisis. But how often is it the team, the whole, coming together to bounce ideas off one another, to envision that desired future state?
Mary, we're going to talk behind Ralph's back when we let him go, in a good way. But I will tell you, what I will say this to you before I go to this final break. I often do think, even though leadership has changed, even though AI has changed our world, technology, et cetera, all these multiple disruptions, I do think in the end, certain people in certain positions as leaders can feel very alone. And somewhat, I'm sure on some level, am I projecting? Yeah, absolutely. But I know I'm not alone. Hey, listen, Ralph, this is a fascinating book. It's called Post-Crisis Leadership, Resilience, Renewal, and Reinvention in the Aftermath of Disruption. Ralph, good stuff. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Mary.
You got it. Mary and I have some final words right after this.
This is Mary Gamba. If you want more leadership tips and tools, log on to stand-deliver.com. That's stand-deliver.com.
Promotional support for this edition of Lessons in Leadership with me, Steve Adubato, and my colleague, Mary Gamba, has been provided by NJ.com, NJBIA, and New Jersey Business Magazine, CIANJ, and Commerce Magazine, and the Meadowlands Chamber and Meadowlands Media.
The North Ward Center continues to expand their services and outreach in Newark from the childhood years to the golden years, offering programs like preschool, youth leadership development, Casa Israel adult medical day program, our Family Success Center, as well as a gymnasium, and most recently, Hope House, a permanent home for adults with autism, supporting and nurturing our autism community, with Hope House 2 coming soon. The North Ward Center, we're here when you need us.
All right, lessons in leadership. Got 3 minutes left. I would call it the 2-minute drill, but we just have three. Hey, listen, Mary, I appreciate what Ralph was saying, Ralph Gelati, about bring the team together in a crisis. All that's true. I got it. Here's the part where I just don't buy this. In the end, if a leader is a great leader, in my opinion, which doesn't make me right, you're alone. You're alone in the middle of the night thinking about keeping the organization going. You're alone in the middle of the night thinking about the future and how to put the pieces together. You're alone thinking about making budget, paying bills, doing what you need to do to keep the ship afloat. I just believe that. That doesn't mean that you don't share at different times with others, but in the end, leadership, at least in my view, is pretty lonely. And that's not, woe is me. It means that's what it means to be a great leader. You are alone in the end. Because if it goes wrong, let me spread it around. This was a team thing. Like, listen, Tom Thibodeau's gone. Okay, yeah, I'm dating myself. We're taping, what day? It's like the 5th.
June 5th, yeah.
All right, Thibodeau's gone. It's not like it was a team thing. The Knicks lost. Let's spread it around. No, he's gone. He was the one in the middle of the night trying to think about the lineup, what to do. He's gone. In the end, you're ultimately responsible. That's the way I see it, Mary.
I disagreed with you right up until when you said, in the end, you're ultimately responsible. Agreed. Are you alone if you are a great leader and build a team around you? I have said to you a million times, I stay up at night. I've shed tears with you recently just about my concerns, my frustrations.
But I don't want you to do that.
Not about me, about the organization. So if you are lucky enough to have somebody on your team, and yes, in this case, I'm talking about me.
It is you.
That literally cares just as much. Sure, I'm not responsible, so thank God I'm definitely able to sleep a little bit better at night because I know
it. In the end, if it goes wrong, this is not us. If it goes wrong, it's not on Mary.
Right, but I think the best leaders surround themselves with people. So in those times, you at least have a shoulder support system. Yes, at the end of the day, you are ultimately responsible, but the great leader surrounds himself.
It's not really me. It's any leader in that
position. Right, that's what I'm saying. Any great leader should surround him, herself, themselves with somebody who gives a darn. So that's
my
final
word. I'm going to make it clear. First of all, Mary's not the average normal team member. Just that's number one. And I know we got to go, but no, and because we do have a great team. But to be clear, the best leaders, when and if things do go wrong, they take it on themselves. They point no fingers. They don't share the blame. They take it themselves. And at times, that feels lonely, and you can't share it with the team. That's just my opinion. For Mary, who is a great leader, and I don't want her staying up at night thinking about what she does, but that's what makes her great. And to Elvin and the team and everyone else, thanks for watching. All right, I'll go to therapy next week. See you then. This edition of Lessons in Leadership is made possible by the Bucino Leadership Institute at Seton Hall University, PragerMedis, Valley Bank, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 825, the North Ward Center, Gingoli Construction, the New Jersey Sharing Network, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, The Helix, Fedway Associates, Inc., the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, Choose New Jersey, and Seton Hall University, showing the world what great minds can do since 1856.
This is Mary Gamba. If you want more leadership tips and tools, log on to stand-deliver.com. That's stand-deliver.com.
Promotional support for this edition of Lessons in Leadership with me, Steve Adubato, and my colleague, Mary Gamba, has been provided by NJ.com, NJBIA, and New Jersey Business Magazine. CIANJ, and Commerce Magazine, and the Meadowlands Chamber and Meadowlands Media.